It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azhatalin? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
Push the button, and that's the show.
Okay.
All right.
So, go.
We could just sit here in silence for an hour.
Hello, darkness, my old friend.
Do you think eventually that would mean we never have to do this again?
Because
that's one thing we haven't tried.
I have regularly pondered if we do bad enough,
yeah,
we get out of it.
But we haven't tried just sitting here doing nothing.
No, but I feel like we've made sounds that are worse than that.
That's true.
I feel like an hour of silence would not be the worst episode we've done.
No, but it would be the least effort for us. Although,
that's true.
For both of us, staying silent actually is kind of an effort.
Yeah. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Magical Talking Hat Podcast, the only podcast in the world that seriously considered just sitting here silently for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And changed our minds, not because of you, but because we just decided it wouldn't work.
No.
I'm Tony.
And I'm William.
And we don't know what episode this is.
Nope.
Because we're not the normal crew.
Nope.
For those of you just joining us, other people who aren't us have a hat. It's magical. It has its own email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. And people, I assume, write in to that email address with little notes, comments, topics, questions, things like that, that the hat gets.
Yeah. People send them in, I guess.
And the hat,
to that,
all on its own, magically transmogrifies those emails into little notes with the information written on them, manifests physically within the hat itself. Those other people who are there, excuse me, servants, draw the note cards out at random, read them aloud, talk about them on the air until they're bored. That's the whole show.
You all right over there?
And when they can't make it, we're here, yes.
Okay.
I don't know what's going on. I'm having an evil allergy attack or
something. Oh,
no. It's like regular allergies, but with a goatee.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we fill in. We're from the evil universe, and we fill in whenever they can't get their shit together. And we hate it, but we do it.
Yep.
What really is probably the issue, you shouldn't come over. I mean, they can't do it if we're not in the same place, and we don't hang out together except when this happens. Because we don't particularly like each other.
That's a fair observation.
I'm always a little surprised when you're here. I've gotten to the point now when I see you show up, I'm like, oh, it probably means we have to record
some podcast. Oh, so from your perspective, I trigger it.
Possibly. I mean, I don't... Well, how do you decide to come here?
I never really thought about it before. I mean,
maybe you should start.
I'm just going about my business, and I decide, well, I guess this would be a good night to go over to Tony's.
Yeah, that's a terrible thought.
And then when I get here, this is what you're doing, and so we do it. So...
That's true. I don't ever podcast any other time.
I mean, it's not like when I walk in the door... You
no,
get.
I'm ready.
Yeah, you're ready to do it like you're expecting me. But you're not.
Weird.
So I can't.
If
you were doing something else when I got here, we'd do that instead.
Maybe.
Well, I mean, I presume so.
I can think of things I could be doing when you come.
No, I'm just saying when I show up, you're already kind of in the process of doing this, and I just sit down and do it with you. So.
Yeah. And I'm just saying. I'm not planning to do it, and then you show up, and then we have to do it. But I can't answer why I'm setting up for podcasts.
Yeah, then. That's what I'm saying. And I can't say why I picked that particular time and date to do to come over. People just come over to people's houses. They don't, you know.
There's a bad man, a part of man. I go over the house. Fuck, yeah. We have to do a podcast. So one of two things is going on. Either some serious, scary hoodoo is happening, or, and this is, I think, the more likely of the two scenarios, we're really not very smart.
Well, that one goes without saying.
Yeah, but I mean, so dumb that, like, this all makes sense. We just can't make
sense.
Like, people are listening right now and saying, duh. Obviously, okay. Blah, 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 blah.
Right, right.
And we're too dumb to be aware of it.
That must be it.
All right. I already explained what's going on, right?
Yep.
All right, so draw something.
No. Yep. From the hat.
William has drawn a small note card out of the hat. What does it say?
It's from Stu.
It's from Stu? I remember that guy. He's Welsh and has no goatee.
What's your favorite Mr. Kipling cake? Cheers. What's Mr. Kipling cake? What is that?
I have no idea.
What's your favorite Mr. Kipling cake?
Did he mean what's your favorite cake, Mr. Kipling? In which case, who's Mr. Kipling?
It's actually, it says, what's your favorite Mr. Kipling cake? But
that's how Welsh people talk. Does it say boyo? That really got you, didn't it?
Yeah, I like that. I like that.
I have no idea what a Mr. Kipling cake is. Maybe it's like Carvel, you know, who has Cookie Puss and Cookie Opus and Fudgy the Whale.
I have no idea.
Maybe this Mr. Kipling cakes have Mount Choco Moore or... You know what would be hilarious?
And what would that be?
So Carvel and other places have cakes and they're themed and they're like shaped like stuff. Somebody should do a cake company where every cake is themed and shaped like stuff, but all of them are either like square or cylindrical. So it's just a cake. But then you're like, oh, it's a grain silo cake. Or like the most lazy ass, like, you know, oh, you ordered the cinder block cake, you know?
I see.
You ordered the roofless woodshed
So cake. They're traditional, just conventional shapes.
Cake. Yes.
But
we try and convince, oh, especially in the shape of... You know, you ordered the single-colored Rubik's cube cake. That's also something I want to invent—a Rubik's cube that's just the same color on
all
sides. Okay,
what's naturally cupcake shaped?
What's naturally cupcake
shaped?
I
see. I don't know anything that
you,
is.
That is not found in nature. Cupcakes are not found in nature. They are wholly.
yeah, I'm
synthetic.
Not. It's not coming to me. What
it's
that
still
would be.
A cylinder, right? It's just a small cylinder,
right? But it's flat on one side and round on the other, and sometimes it can flare out closer to the top. But it's not parallel sides or whatever.
Well, don't do it that way.
Okay. Well, even if you made it so that it had parallel sides, it would still be round at the top.
Well, crap.
I suppose you could make it so they're not and make them more like hockey pucks.
You just put
the hockey puck cake. It's just a cupcake with a round top.
Aren't those just ding-dongs?
Wait a minute. No. Come on. You got to go with the theme here.
No. I'm sorry. Ding-dongs. are the, like you can't take it away from them. Those are so just hockey pucks. There cannot be another hockey puck.
Okay, well, what looks like a hockey puck that's not a hockey puck?
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I just realized something.
What?
Could these be cakes shaped like a dude named Mr. Kipper?
I don't know. But how could we have a favorite if that's the case?
Here's my there's a guy, there's a baker named Kipling in Wales. And he makes a lot of cakes. And a rite of passage for all children is to go with your friends and steal one of them and eat it. And so he wants to know what our favorite of those cakes
maybe it's
are.
A brand like Hostess or something.
We do not steal cakes. We're good American people.
Maybe it's a brand like Hostess or Dolly Madison or something.
Or in which case, again, we're Americans. You sheep-loving bastard.
I have no idea what a Mr. Kipling cake
is. But then again, the most famous Welsh building in the world is shaped like a loaf of bread, so I don't even know.
You're saying they love their baked goods.
Apparently. That's what we must be going for here. And, okay, there's a famous Rudyard Kipling. Is an author, yes?
Yeah, yeah.
Was he Welsh?
I don't know.
Was he fond of cake?
I don't know.
What about Mrs. Kipling? Doesn't she like cake? No, weirdly, that's the thing. It's Mr. Kipling's cakes and Mrs. Kipling's pizza. That's what she does. They're a little mom and pop bakery / pizzeria that became a chain throughout Wales. Okay, Stu, I have a question for you. How did you think this was going to go?
You mean, did he know that we didn't know what he was going
to
talk about?
Straight up fucking with us and just wanted to grind the episode to a halt. Or he has lived in this country for quite a few years and has not figured out that whatever this is doesn't exist here. So he's either a massive idiot or a massive asshole. So either way, and I say massive, this is on a scale of a podcast episode, so everybody rein it in. But what is, yeah. How did you see this playing out?
It's all right, Stu.
Boyo.
The thing is, that's the way you look at it. The way I look at it is I feel bad for not knowing what he's talking about.
You're like everyone else knows.
Yeah.
We can pull someone off the street.
And they'll know.
It's Kipling cake, yes.
But we
My
don't
My favorite
know.
Is jalapeno chocolate.
So.
My favorite
So while you just said.
Coconut turpentine.
So while you just said either he's a massive idiot or a massive asshole. I'm the idiot.
Wait.
Because I don't know. For sure.
And even if I knew, I wouldn't tell him. Because fuck that guy. And Mr. Kipling. And the cake he wrote in on. No, I will say this. I'm saddened to know that there is a kind of cake. Or cakes. I mean, because we're supposed to pick a favorite.
That you're not aware of.
Yeah, that's sad.
Yeah, well.
Because I love cake.
I know.
Cake is awesome.
I like cake too.
Here's to you, Mr. Kipling, wherever you are. What are you doing? I'm drawing.
I'm not drawing. I'm just moving the hat closer to you so you can draw.
I saw you reaching for the hat.
And I was just pushing it your way.
All right. Thanks for your question. All right. What do we got?
That doesn't sound very sincere after all.
This is anonymous. Would you describe yourself as a cynic? Why bother? Everyone else is gonna anyway. Was that suitably cynical?
Yeah.
All right. You frequently describe yourself as an optimist, which I find kind of funny.
Why is that?
Because you're frequently not optimistic.
Okay. See, that's interesting you should say that, because this question has actually been bothering me a lot lately.
you literally just experienced it right now. Wait, you've been asking yourself if you're a cynic?
No. No, here's the thing. I think one of the reasons you're so amused at my saying I'm an optimist is because, okay, the thing is,
your life is so objectively bleak.
I think anyone who gets to know me well and is familiar with certain philosophical schools of thought and or certain rural American tendencies, they would say, I come from a long tradition of Stoics. And Stoicism as a philosophy is not typically thought of as optimistic.
No.
So when I talk to other philosophically minded people about optimism or hope, okay, yeah. There's a word I like to use, and they describe what they understand as optimism or hopefulness, and what they're describing is something that's like sort of a blind positiveness that I clearly do not subscribe to, I have to say, okay, well, then I do not subscribe to those schools of optimism or hope that you're describing. And so I find myself lacking the words to describe what I think or feel, because one group of people takes any word like optimism or hope, like optimism, if you're an optimist or if you have an optimistic outlook, you believe in things like The Secret or the Law of Attraction, the Power of Positive Thinking and stuff like that, which I clearly don't subscribe to those things. Or if you have hope, you're some person that is disconnected from reality and you think things are going to happen that maybe have no possibility of happening or are so unlikely to happen, it's ridiculous for you to have. But I don't subscribe to that use of the word hope either. But there are so many people out there who hear that when they hear the words hope or optimism that I almost can't use those words to describe my sense of, I don't even know what to call it. And as far as cynicism goes, no, I never would have thought of myself as a cynic, but I think if I was in philosophical circles, they would think, well, you're clearly an existentialist, a pragmatist, a Stoic, and probably a pessimist. But then most of my friends would never think of me as a pessimist.
No. And actually, I should explain why it's amusing. you're more than one thing, in my opinion.
Hmm.
There are certain spheres in which you are absolutely optimistic, and there are certain spheres in which you are quite pessimistic. And those spheres, we need spheres for our party. Get some spheres, and tears, and music, tears for me, spheres. Those spheres specifically are, I think you are incredibly pessimistic about you and your life. And as soon as you step out of yourself to other people around you, friends, loved ones, and the world as a whole, I think you're very optimistic.
Well, I think that's probably true. Which is to say that...
To be optimistic, there is the thing of hope that you still believe things can get better and that they might. But to me, there's also very much a
looking on the bright side and giving the benefit of the doubt and things like that tied up into what I would call optimism.
Okay, well, and again, those are things that I do.
Yes.
But I think,
externally.
I think in what you just described, where I'm pessimistic about things concerning me and optimistic about others, I think that what's really going on there is I'm probably seeing, on everyone else, I'm probably seeing, as you said, the bright side or the potential, the positive potential there. And the rules that I apply to myself and how I look at others, I don't apply back to myself. Yeah. And so I'm harder on myself. And really the pessimism that I apply to myself isn't a healthy Stoic kind of pessimism. It's kind of a, I'm too hard on myself kind of pessimism.
And I want you to pay very close attention because I've never said these words to you. And I do not believe I will ever say them again.
What?
I don't think you're particularly unusual in this. I think this is a perspective that a lot of people
have. Oh, no, I'm sure that's true, yeah. In fact, I know it's true for some people I know.
Yeah. I will never say that to you again.
Why?
Because I'm constantly explaining to you. Remember? Unless I name you specifically.
Oh, yeah. Because that makes me like everybody else.
The concept that you have something in common with other humans is not something I've ever brought up before, because it doesn't happen. But I think this might be the one thing.
But the thing is, sometimes I'll hear other Stoics...
Also bipedalism.
Sometimes I'll hear other Stoics, you know, lauding the virtues and values of pessimism, right? And specifically what they're saying is, they're talking about, in your worldview, taking into account that things might not work out the way you want them to.
Yeah.
And that, you know, sometimes the world's just going to be crappy.
Well, and this is the standard, if you always expect the worst, then you're pleasantly surprised.
Well,
you know, and you're not disappointed.
Not so much like that, just encouraging people to not be unrealistic in their expectations. And okay, that's fine. And I'm that's completely the way I think about things. But then the pessimist will end by saying, you know, what you'll find when you make peace with the crappy way that the world can be is that you can get through it. Which sounds like a very optimistic and hopeful message, if you ask me. And of course, that's also what I believe. But I call those things optimism and hopefulness, even though my pessimist friend refuses to do that because they think those concepts are too closely tied to pie-in-the-sky notions and whatever, and also tied to this notion of disappointment, because I get this all the time. It's like, you know, William, why do you have hope? Because when you have hope, you're disappointed. And the fact of the matter is, the person who says that to me thinks of that when they're not thinking I'm disappointed when I have hope, they're thinking I'm disillusioned when I have hope. But the fact of the matter is, my hope is not a delusional thing. It's just, for me, what hope means, and faith, I guess, in a little bit different way, just means I know what the odds are this is going to happen, and then maybe the odds aren't good, but I'm going to go forward trying to make it happen, trying to increase the odds of it happening, and planning as if it's going to happen, because if it does happen, I want to be ready to move to the next thing.
Yeah.
And so all of my thought and action is around the notion that this is going to happen. I don't forget that it might not happen. I don't forget that the odds are against me even.
Yeah.
I'm just going to act as if it's going to happen, because it might. I might actually increase the odds by what I do, and then if it does happen, I'm ready for the next thing
and
right
that,
away.
There's a distinction that I don't know that we have a linguistic organization for, and that's there are two outlooks we're talking about here. One is how you think things are going to go, and one is what potential outcomes you choose to focus on.
Yes, right.
So, I'm saying I really want to get good at this particular sport. I'm not saying I will. I'm not saying, you know what? I'm going to be a star athlete. I'm saying, I may even be saying, you know what? I'm old. I've never done it. I'm in poor shape. Odds are not good. I'm aware of that.
Yeah.
But I'm also like, but I really want to, and I'm going to try my hardest.
Yeah.
And I hope I do it.
That's right.
And that's cool. And those are two very distinct
things. Right. And when you go into it doing the stuff you just said, when it doesn't work out, you're not disappointed. I mean, nothing happened that you didn't know or expect was going to happen.
Well, and there still can be some disappointment, but some's okay. Like, oh, I really did hope, but I didn't do it.
Exactly.
But it's not like, oh my God, I was not expecting I would fail, as the odds were so... like...
Right, so oftentimes when I go into something clearly hopeful or optimistic, and I even use those terms to describe it, I think people immediately think, oh, he's not aware of what the odds are or how this can go wrong.
Yeah.
And if something does go wrong, and like you say, I'm disappointed... They think I'm crushed disappointed because I was, but I'm not crushed disappointed.
Well,
I'm just
again,
regular
feel like
disappointed.
This is a linguistic shortcoming because I don't think we can use optimist pessimist for
See,
both.
That's
of
what
those.
I'm starting to think. That's what I'm starting to think is I
well,
just don't even
don't
have
think
the words.
It works because if we just say I'm an optimist, unless you say I'm an optimist, I'm talking about this scenario.
Yeah, right.
This one, doesn't work. So one set gets to be optimist and pessimist, and the other set doesn't. And I think the people you're talking about, and I think most people, view the one about how you expect things to go as the determination of the words are really losing it.
Optimist and pessimist.
So they associate it with the expectation. So therefore, an optimist believes things are going to go well, and a pessimist believes they will not. Irrespective of what they hope will happen and what they are trying for and what they're focusing on, I think that's how the people you're talking about are viewing it. And if that's the case, that's great. Then we need another word set for how, because that's totally a thing that people are really hopeful and like gonna try real hard, and other people who are like, why bother?
Well, I mean,
I don't even care, you know.
You know, I used to tell people where we worked, you know, the thing that I would say all the time is hope and then hope some more. You know, and I just meant by that go into this thing like the best possible case scenario is going to happen, because that's how you're going to psychologically be able to notice and see the opportunities to make it happen. But what I think people heard me saying was, totally delude yourself about what's going on around you, which I wasn't saying at all, because I would never want someone to be delusional.
Well, what's the classic saying? Plan for the worst, hope for the best. That literally is talking about the two different sides we're talking about. Yeah. You plan for the worst because you know what's going to happen and you're prepared, but you hope for the best because much like the placebo effect with medication, your attitude can totally influence the outcome. So if you go in thinking, oh man, what's the point or whatever, you're going to increase the odds it's going to suck. And if you go and say, I'm going to try my hardest and I really hope, even if the odds are not in your favor, you're going to help them by having that attitude.
Yeah, what's the other... Another thing people say is, shoot for the stars and reach the moon or something like that. But even this word cynic is disconnected from its original Greek philosophical, you know, sources. So it all comes down to, we've got these words that...
Oh, words.
It's hard to know what they mean, and they mean different things to different people in different contexts. And there doesn't, like you were saying, there doesn't seem to be a word for what I'm actually trying to convey.
Oh my God, see, it is, you are not like other humans. You're just William.
No, the thing is, I think the way I use... The thing is, again, I come from... I was raised in a very stoic situation. It wasn't until I went to college that I realized there was actually a Greek philosophical tradition that was very much like the culture I grew up in. But the culture I grew up in...
Culture Dalinism.
No. The culture I grew up in did use words like faith, hope, and so on and so forth, the same way I use them. Not as delusions. You know, here's another thing.
As farmer's daughters.
No. Here's another example. You ever hear someone say, well, I'm not an optimist or a pessimist. I'm a realist.
Yes, I fucking hate those.
Which is setting up false contrast there. And that's not really how those things work.
And the implication, very much so, is that everybody who's one of those things is not realistic.
Exactly.
So that's, I put that guy up there with the archetypical atheist, the archetypical vegan, and the archetypical guy who's into CrossFit. They, you know the joke, a vegan, an atheist, and a guy really into CrossFit walk into a bar. We know this because they won't stop talking about
But I mean, to me, an optimist is just someone who, looking at the odds, let's say the odds are, there's a 40% chance this is going to work out. But an optimist is someone who says, all right, well, I'm going to try to beat those odds
never,
or whatever.
Never tell me the odds.
No, I'm saying you're just going into it with the outlook that, okay, this 40% is not impossible. It could still happen. I'm going to go forward as if it will happen. That's the optimist. The pessimist is someone who says, okay, those odds, I'm going to lose.
Well,
and so I'm not going to go forth as if those odds are going to help me.
In a certain,
so it's all situational.
About, a person who is doing something for which the odds are low, if they are a pessimist, they probably won't try.
Probably
not. If they are an optimist, they will probably try their hardest.
Yeah.
But I think it's a semantic argument, because I'm not sure you get to call that optimist and pessimist. Because again, there's the other side of people just being aware of likelihood of things.
Yeah.
But we need to make the distinction, and whichever one gets optimist and pessimist, the other one needs a different set of labels.
Well, okay, then there's the whole glass is half empty. Is this glass half empty or half full? The fact of the matter is, if I say the glass is half empty, I'm logically at the same time saying...
Yes, and also it's always full because the other half's full of air.
Well, that too, but I mean, you see what I'm saying? Yes. If it's half full of water, that means it's half empty of water. I mean, you can't say one really without saying the other. How is one qualitatively different than the other really? It's just, like you said, it just portrays a language problem where we can't describe the state simultaneously as both things without favoring one or the other.
Well, but that's the thing. So the I'm going to call this the William definition and the other people definition. The other people definition that works, the other people definition, it's not even a thing because everybody's going to know. So the other people definition, that's a terrible model.
Yeah.
For yours, it could be a model because one person could be like, oh, it's only half full. I wanted more water than that. And the other person is like, it's only half full, but it's water, and I like water, I'm thirsty. And that's the optimist.
But that strikes me that person's not an optimist. They're just grateful. They just have a measure of gratitude more than the other person has.
Well, but
or
in that
they're
case,
just happy about...
So what you're stating there is that it doesn't... When it's just an observational thing, it doesn't matter.
That's what There's it seems no,
you,
to me.
You can't be pessimistic or optimistic about an observation.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, what the idea is that... Okay. Is that there's two ways to describe this that are equal, and the one you choose on a whim is going to give away your own personal philosophy of life.
Absolutely overly simplistic.
Yeah, right.
I mean, that's how those things work.
Yeah.
Okay, but so let's do this.
Okay.
So you're going to do something.
Yeah.
Or at least you're considering doing something, and you don't know the odds. And realistically... You can't even really find out.
Okay. That happens. That's a realistic scenario. Very realistic.
So, where was I going with this?
I don't know.
Where does your optimism and your pessimism fall in? How does an optimist approach this versus a pessimist in this situation?
That's a good question. I mean, as a Stoic, the first thing I'm going to do is probably... try to figure out what the worst case scenario is.
Okay.
So, and we've talked about this before. If there's something that I might embark on doing, I don't think of why I shouldn't do it. I think of why I should do it.
All right.
So what's the benefit going to be, even if the worst case scenario is the thing that I end up with?
Okay.
If the worst case scenario doesn't give a benefit, and of course worse if it harms people, and having no other guide for like what the odds are of the worst case scenario not being the thing that's going to happen, or being the thing that's going to happen, whatever you want to say, I'll probably avoid it.
All right. The worst
just case, to be safe.
The worst case scenario in this hypothetical thing
mm-hmm.
is that afterwards you feel physically unwell, and that may last for as long as a day or two. It won't kill you, but you may be a sick, essentially.
Or permanently damage me?
No, not permanent.
Okay.
No, not permanently.
I will fully recover from whatever
yes,
it is.
Yes. If it's successful, the best case scenario,
mm-hmm.
you will feel really great and happy and just full of life and pleased. For probably half a day, and then you go back to normal.
And that's all I have is how I'm going to feel about it. What about other results? Like
no other results.
Is anyone else going to be helped by it?
No,
it
is a wholly internal process.
So it's the only. So it's all about how I'm going to feel at the end of it.
Yes, yes. It will have impact only on your body and your mind, but you have no concept and not even sure where you could find such a resource to tell you what the odds are, which and there's also it could land anywhere in the middle of that range.
Okay, sure.
Well, you could just end up being like nothing happened.
I'm pretty sure I wouldn't do it.
Now, is that position indicative of anything along an optimism, pessimism?
Well, I think my reasoning would be, I could spend my time doing something that's going to have an impact on someone other than just me.
So it's essentially too masturbatory. There's no point. It's navel gazing.
Yeah.
All right. Interesting. Because what I invented in my head was just recreational drug use.
That was what I went with.
Oh.
Which, certain types of recreational drug use. There's other ones that could have much more far-reaching. But like, you know, let's say you were going to try weed or something. That's pretty much what the scenario is right there for you.
Well, and that's actually a good example because providing I don't have to smoke it, because smoking weed is really bad. Well, because,
yeah, you're putting shit in
your smoking's lungs. Not a good of any kind. But if I was ingesting it, I happen to not think that marijuana is particularly harmful.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of being a drug, it's probably no different, has no different impact on my body than the chocolate I eat. Even though it has a different effect.
Dosage issues, but yeah.
Exactly, dosage issues aside. Why wouldn't I then do it? Well, because I've got better things to do.
There you go.
I just got better things to do.
But that was the best one I can think of. And, you know, some people do have a reaction or something's weird about it, and you've never tried it, so potentially it could make you,
yeah,
for a couple
that's
days.
Right. That's
going to be the issue. And then the other direction is, dude, I feel awesome for, like, several hours, and that's it. And so, and in this scenario, you're, like, alone in your house. Or like,
sure,
and
sure.
There's no legal ramification or anything like that.
Well,
that was what I put
in my head.
We're
also assuming I don't have an illness that could, that,
yes.
Like, I wouldn't be opposed to using marijuana medicinally if I had cancer or something.
Yeah.
I mean,
but I thought this was interesting, Mike, because I essentially already knew your position, and I thought, now, if we do this blind, does the logic you're talking about still follow? And apparently it does.
Yeah, I've got better things to do. I mean, I've heard people describe...
Which, honestly, is the number one best argument against doing pot ever. I'm just going to say that. Irrespective of what my own views on pot would be, the best argument ever against not doing pot is you've got better things to do. And there's no arguing against it. Because there are definitely better things to do than pot. And a lot of them have a very low bar to entry. like, you don't do... Yeah, no. Yeah. So,
well, I mean,
so,
that... Yeah.
That's like the faith argument with the Bible. You just can't argue against it.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I've heard people talk about their experiences.
Now I just want to imagine. I want to see somebody try and argue with somebody that, in fact, they do not have better things to do than weed. That would be hilarious. Like, no, really, I know the kind of shit you do. you have nothing better to do. I know.
Well, but there are people who argue that. I've had people suggest to me that how could I know that what I want to do is better than doing weed if I've never done weed?
Well, and technically speaking, they are not wrong. But technically speaking, that is true of every experience everywhere.
That's right.
Exactly. All you have to draw on is what you have learned, and, you know, people talk to you, you read stuff, things like that, and I assume you have to a degree.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel like there's not going to be a lot of people who are going to be, dude, weed is the most useful. Like, and I'm not talking about people are big into hemp and people are big into the uses of marijuana. That's not what we're talking about.
No.
I'm talking about this afternoon, the best use of your time, the most productive, the most, you know, useful.
Yeah.
Get high. No. I don't know. Like, the most hardcore potheads I've ever known wouldn't argue that.
Although...
They'd be like, it's the most awesome use of your time.
I've
but in terms of, like, contributing to the world,
I've met people, though, who feel like using marijuana helps their creative process.
Yeah, they've actually done studies, and that's a lot.
Sure, sure.
But,
Well, I've just heard people say that.
Yeah, you know.
I've just heard people say
that. That is a thing. But they haven't specifically done studies. And I mean, you can't make that argument, and there are hardcore professionals that fall under that. Not, not to drop names here, but Seth Rogen believes that and uses that. And Seth Rogen is quite a successful filmmaker at this point. And in fact, the other day, I got to watch the last 18 minutes of This Is the End, and that movie is still fucking hilarious. And I don't understand why. On paper, I should hate that movie. Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg wrote a stoner comedy about the apocalypse that heavily features Jonah Hill and James Franco, in addition to Seth Rogen. And it's, yeah, it's a total stoner comedy. Like, nothing about this sounds like it would be enjoyable. But it's hilarious. I recommend it to everyone over grown up. I mean, it has bad words and shit like that. Like, it's not for kids. But it's hilarious. Hilarious.
Well, to answer the question, I don't think...
Well, I feel like cynic is in a whole different
category. Yeah, I don't think there's really any definition of cynic that would apply to me. What's often held up as the opposite of cynic is idealist or romantic, and I don't think I'm those things either, although I've been accused of being those things.
I always find idealist a very tricky term. I'm like, I have ideals. Like,
yeah, right. When I read 19th century fiction that has romantic, and by romantic I don't mean lovey-dovey, I mean romantic as an idealist, and
yeah.
There are aspects of that I like. I don't like when they're really gushy about it, you know.
Yeah.
But there are some aspects of it I like that I would characterize as, the reason I like them is because I'd characterize it as optimistic.
Yeah.
You know, not idealistic. But see, those words, they don't really work. You know, seeing like, it's like I'm reading these things and I like them because it seems like all the media you get today puts such a negative spin on everything. Like, makes it worse than it really is. So when I read something that puts a positive spin on things, it still bothers me because it still distorts it. But it feels a little bit better because it seems closer to reality than all the negative stuff that's just been washing over me.
There's just the balance issue.
Yeah. This is what cognitive dissonance is what's going on, I think.
I push so hard with people for positive feedback, both to receive it and to give it out. And I will always state that I believe positive feedback is equally important to negative feedback. Not more, not less, equally important.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And yet, I seem to focus on it a lot more, and it's because I'm compensating for the rest of the goddamn world that is so focused on negative feedback.
Yeah, I think that's how I am too. But see, then again, most of the 19th century fiction I like is gothic fiction, which is schizophrenic in a way, because on one hand, there's all that romantic stuff going on, but you have all the horror going on too, so it's, they balance each other out in a very satisfying way to me. That's why I like it. But I don't know.
All right. So thanks for your question, Anonymous. I'll draw another one. This one is from Beth. You've each worked numerous jobs. How do you decide when it's time to move on to a new one? Also, if this job goes below 55 miles an hour, it will explode.
Well, about the time someone tells you you're fired, that's when you think, maybe I better look for something else. No, I've Who been...
says, can I talk to you for a second in my office?
I've of the 20 or so jobs I've had in my life, probably, I've only been laid off from two. And I was laid off. I wasn't fired. There was a downsizing in one of them. The one was a downsize... One was downsizing as people understand it, right? They're just getting rid of people.
Twiglet just decided he's mad at the thing he's sitting on for no reason.
Actually, what it was the company I was working for sold a certain part of their business, and everybody who worked in that part of their business lost their jobs. And in the other one...
they closed the call center where we were all working.
Well,
except you were gone before that happened.
I left before that happened. And in the other one I was laid off from... I was working for a nonprofit that this guy was funding with his regular business, and his business partners decided they didn't want him doing that anymore.
So then you lost the funding.
I've never being let go from a job because of poor performance or anything like that.
Yeah, I have.
A lot of other just once, though. A lot of other jobs I left because I was moving because like school ended or my spouse got a job somewhere else.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of a job where I just thought, you know, I should be making some more money. And so I applied for a job somewhere else and I got a better paying job. I don't think that has ever happened to me.
That happened to me once. When I moved here.
Well,
that's
why you moved here for a job?
Well, no. I wanted, well, there were combination things. The biggest one was I wanted to get out of Grinnell and come to Iowa City. But I also had been working a year and a half at a place that was paying me less than starting people at McDonald's and was never going to give me a raise. So that was a factor also.
No, the only time I've ever, every single time I ever left a job was, again, those two times I was, there was a layoff situation and where I was moving, you know, or something like that. The only time I can think of where I ever consciously left a job because I thought I was moving on to something better was when I left my last job.
Yeah.
And that's the only time.
In general, I want to have a job and just stick with it forever. Now I'm at ACT. I hope I'll be there till I retire. I mean, the obvious answer is if you are unhappy at your job and feel that you might be able to get a job somewhere you would be happier, then you should do that. Well, and you and I have sort of similar and I think not super common views on the whole workplace phenomenon. You're going to be there a lot. It needs to be something that you're cool with a big chunk of your life being at.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, obviously, I'm the dude who doesn't want to work. If I could get paid to not work, that would be fine with me. But insofar as I have to, insofar as a job is a job, I love what I'm doing now. I feel like I'm making a difference. I feel like I'm working for a good company. I feel like I am respected. And I love the people I'm with.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have that, try and find that.
Mm-hmm.
But do it at your own pace because there are other factors like the job market, where you live, whether or not you can move because of other reasons, whether or not you're willing to move in order to find that kind of job, how much money you've got and how much you can afford to not. Because I also started this job as one of the lowest paying jobs I ever had. But that was okay. First of all, because I spent a long time unemployed, and so as badly as I was getting paid, it was better than $0.
Mm-hmm.
And also because I was married to someone who was making enough that that was feasible. Sometimes you don't have those options. But insofar as all the other complications that you have to deal with, are you happy? Are you satisfied? Do you like what you do? Are you not ashamed of what you do? Are you making enough money for you? That kind of
thing. And it's good as if you get up in the morning and you actually kind of like to go into work.
Yeah,
but at the very least, do you not hate going into work?
I this is my favorite job of any job I've ever had by a long shot. Even I'm not like woo work.
But no. You don't hate it.
No, I really don't. I really don't. In fact, I like a lot of things.
That's
about
important.
It.
If you hate it, you probably should be looking for something else. Because you don't have to hate it.
To not go that day, I would stay here. But no, I don't hate it. I'm no longer the person who's like, oh man, I have to go to work, and I've had those jobs.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have that. I'm like, okay, go to work. That's fine.
Yeah, you don't have to hate your job.
You do not.
You might not love it, but you don't have to hate
it. Here's the thing. You can have a shit job and not hate it.
Yeah.
Which is poor to say because I'm trying to use myself as an example. I don't have a shit job. But what I have is a really unassuming job.
Hmm.
I'm clerical support in an office in a bunch of cubicles. Like, that's a pretty archetypical, like, that's
pretty Dilbert.
Yeah, and that's the job nobody once when they're a kid in school or anything like that. Like, this is not a job people aspire to, per se.
I want to grow up to be Dilbert.
I like it. And if actually not long ago, I actually got promoted, but still in the same job. Like, it's the same job, but now I have a 2 at the end instead of a 1. Mm-hmm. But I'm happy about it. I'm very happy about that, actually. But that's about as far as I can go in this job, and it may be this is it. This is the job I'm in for. I'm okay with that. Mm-hmm. I like it. Mm-hmm. I feel I contribute, and I'm okay with that. So it doesn't have to be, you know, everybody. Well, and you used to be, too. Like, what do you like doing? What's your passion? That should be your job. Mm-hmm. Ideally, yes. Doesn't have to be. And you can still like your job. You can still love your job.
Sure, right.
Like me, yeah. No, I'm like, I really have a passion for making photocopies. No, not a thing. I still really like my job.
Yep.
So, yeah. All right. Well, let's grab one more. I think we got some time.
This has been digested.
Gross.
And it's from Stu.
Stu. That Welsh guy?
As 1950s Biff Tanner placed bets from the sports almanac, wouldn't that affect future sporting outcomes? Cheers, Stu. As 1950s placed bets.
Back in the future.
I know, but how would it affect future sporting outcomes?
This is a good question. Well, I mean, potentially it affects the odds.
Yeah.
So then the odds should change. I don't know how placing a bet on something changes who wins later,
or how changing the odds. Would a team found out the odds for them winning and the point spread or something was better, or that they'd be less discouraged or something?
If it changed the point spread, theoretically it could. Although supposedly that doesn't happen either. Supposedly,
right?
Teams
but,
don't do that.
Yeah, I don't know.
No, I don't think so. But it's also a moot point because none of Back to the Future works.
No.
Here's the bit with time travel. If you change something, none of the same people are born. This is the thing nobody understands. There's not the version of you in this timeline.
Yeah.
Because that only happens if literally everything is the same. Because the same fucking sperm has to get to the same fucking egg and divide in the same way. I'm like, there are quantum level changes that make for completely different people.
Yeah.
Which actually, not long ago, I heard a theory that explains why Marty is still himself in the new version of the future, because it's not the same Marty. Because Doc Brown, since he actually got proof of concept in 1955 for his time machine, was able to get it way earlier than we all think about, and has basically been a goddamn Time Lord ever since, hopping around, and is obsessed with Marty McFly. So, you know, he's going around and picking and choosing the ones from the timelines he wants. And he clearly took the original timeline Marty and dumped him in the new one. Whereas in reality, it wouldn't be Marty. It'd be somebody else. Because seriously, their whole lives, his parents' whole lives changed completely. Oh, yeah. They're very different people.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no way in hell that same sperm and that same egg got to meet up. Never happened.
Highly unlikely, yeah.
Astronomically unlikely.
Yep, you're right.
Like, I'm comfortable in saying impossible.
You're probably right. Because, I mean, so everything was different, and yet, you know, they got together on the exact same night at the exact same time to conceive him, for example.
And they didn't have any additional recent sex that would have changed which ones are there. None of the process. Like, so many things have to go exactly the same.
And to
say nothing of the fact they're leading different lifestyles, which means their health is different, which especially, at least in the women's case, is going to impact everything, including cycles.
Well, and actually, yes. Yeah, epigenetics.
Epigenetics all up the motherfucker.
And the implication was that they had a better relationship, marriage, probably, or having sex more often.
The implication was very strongly they were having sex more often. Yeah. They were very frisky. That was a thing.
Yeah. But they only had the same kids and the same number of kids.
But this is a constant thing. Every time you do alternate version, and it's supposed to be an alternate timeline,
mm-hmm.
because it doesn't happen, people, because... Yeah, we're seriously dealing with quantum level changes here.
That's right.
Like, literally the charge of the atomic charge on something could change the division of the cells. I mean, there. And then you've got a different person. To say nothing of, even if somehow we're dealing with the exact same biological components, which we are not, their lives change. The way they raised you is different.
Yeah, yeah.
Your environment is going to be different. You potentially went to a different school. You definitely have a different socioeconomic situation.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not that same kid.
Yeah. There's you have to. Insane. There's a lot to a lot of suspension of disbelief
and
there.
I understand, and that's the thing. I get more comfortable with that now that I know the tropes. It's the same way that I love the Assassin's Creed games, even though it's all predicated on this idea that your genetics has the experiences and memories of your ancestors, which is the dumbest thing ever. But it's such a commonly used trope that I'm like, yeah, it's that thing, whatever.
Yeah,
let's move on.
Let's roll with
from
it.
There.
Yep.
And this is the same one. Alternate timeline ones is another one.
Yep.
Another one that I still just hurts me. I can't really deal with this. Is the 10% of your brain thing. Is the Lucy thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
That one I just hate because I'm like, there's so many other ways around. We don't have to use that. We don't have to keep using that bullshit. We can achieve the exact same thing. Like, we can totally do, like, your brain has expanded and you know this stuff and in a way that's not based on this science that is absolute bullshit.
Right, right.
That we're pretending is real.
Right.
Because, like, you could say that aliens, like, expanded your consciousness.
Sure.
And that also is largely bullshit at this point. I don't know if aliens doing that.
You've doubled the concentration of neurons in your brain somehow.
But nobody...
Doubled the connections. Lots of ways.
Nobody is going to be like, oh, that's a real thing. Whereas the 10% brain thing, everybody's like, oh yeah, imagine if you could use more.
Yeah, yeah.
No,
yeah,
fuck off. It's not a thing.
It's not a thing.
Also, they found the remains of Amelia Earhart in 1940 on a nearby island. So stop being mysterious about that. That is super true.
Yes, I'm aware of that one.
It's not a mystery, people. We know what happened. Yeah, spoiler. Oh my god, William dies at the end of the podcast.
Wait, what?
I wish I just cut the feed right there. No, remember that's our constant spoiler.
I know, but you add it at the end of the podcast.
It's funnier. And because I'm going to kill you.
Well, I'm not upset that you're going to kill me. I'm upset that you told me, because now I know.
That's true. No surprise. But I promise I will not kill you until you reach the top. I've got some rope up here, but I do not think you will accept my help.
No good. I've known too many Spaniards.
I'm only waiting around to finish the podcast, which we should do now.
All right.
So go to the blog, themagicaltalkinghead.com, and tell us everything we got wrong. And things we got right, if you feel like it, whatever. I'm optimistic. Or am I?
Yeah.
Like us on Facebook. Write into the hat with questions. You can see we need them. We go through more of them than the other guys do, and that's a good thing. But you should write in more so we have more. And listen again next week, because that will give them incentive to do it, and then we don't have to.
Yep.
All right. Prepare to die.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.